Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service and PRI.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Democrats in Washington are scrambling to save health care reform in the event that tomorrow, in a special election, Massachusetts voters send a Republican to fill the Senate seat held by the late Ted Kennedy. We'll have the news from Washington in a few minutes, but first, how close is that special election? Democrat and Attorney General Martha Coakley, whose double-digit lead over Republican Scott Brown evaporated in the past 2 weeks, referred to Martin Luther King Jr.'s dream at a breakfast this morning.
I would be honored to go to Washington and to work for you and with you, because we all know that as we remember that dream, we need to make sure that we act on it and that everybody who wants to can follow his own dream in this state and in this country. Thank you very much, everybody. Have a great day. Thank you.
But Republican Scott Brown told his supporters yesterday,
We've come a long way. We still have a long way to go. We're not taking anything for granted.
Here in Fred Tice joins us in the studio. Fred, national commentators are surprised by the closeness of this race. You'd be less so if you lived here and have heard the drumbeat building on local talk radio. We'll have more on that later in the program. But, Fred, you were out there today. What are the moods in the campaigns today?
Well, the campaigns are two very different campaigns. One is on defense, one is on offense. Martha Coakley's on defense. She is just trying to get all the Democrats to come out and vote tomorrow. On the other hand, Scott Brown is trying to bring more people into the race who may not normally vote the independents, by and large, those angry voters. So they're focusing on just energizing those voters. Those are voters who may not always show up at the polls.
Well, the Coakley campaign, as we've said, only seemed to wake up to Brown's momentum last week. You had President Obama and Bill Clinton coming to town for her. Former New York Mayor Giuliani came in for Scott Brown. It's been, you can't even drive around town. It's been so crowded. But does either campaign feel that this past weekend's events changed the momentum in any way?
Yeah, I went with both campaigns this weekend and got two very, very different moods. Let's talk a little bit about the Coakley campaign first. Small crowds, dedicated supporters, people who wanted to be energized by her so they can go out and make phone calls for her, but definitely subdued crowds. We spoke to one Coakley voter up in Gloucester, Massachusetts this weekend, and here he is.
I think it was a sleepy little race up until about 2 weeks ago, and suddenly people are turning in on the TV set, seeing ads, and as of today, I think this is a pretty good turnout for just a quick, you know, can you come down and listen to Martha speak, so that's why I'm here.
So some Coakley supporters are feeling like, you know, there is maybe a new realization. What are you hearing from Brown supporters?
Well, the thing with the Brown supporters is that everywhere I go, you just see him being overwhelmed with people who want to hear what he has to say. I mean, for example, on Saturday I was at in a place called Middleborough, Massachusetts, a small cafe where he was going to do a little speech. And I get there, and the place is just overflowing. He ends up having to do this rally in the gas station across the street because the people can't go into the building, into the little cafe anymore. And you get all kinds of people who are showing up for all kinds of reasons. One of the issues that's firing people up is health care. People feel that it's gone too fast, and that the process hasn't been open enough. And I spoke to a voter where this happened.
It's outrageous that we're subsidizing the insurance of the people in Nebraska, the people in Louisiana, the state workers, and the union workers. We are subsidizing them.
So again, Fred Tice, there's a Scott Brown supporter. And this morning, Cokie Roberts on NPR pointed out an irony that the Brown supporters are against reform that was based on a program they already have and that he voted for here in Massachusetts. But they are angry about health care as well as what other issues?
Yeah, and part of the anger at health care, Robin, is from firsthand experience. I mean, I spoke to Scott Brown supporter, a guy whose son is now heading to Afghanistan. He was telling me he is for Scott Brown because he doesn't want to have to buy health insurance. You know, he's here in Massachusetts. He's got to buy that health insurance, and he thinks that's a bad idea.
Yeah, okay.
And I'm hearing a lot of that. So the health care was a big thing. But in the end, I think there was this voter in Middleborough who really boiled it down for me. He mentioned all these reasons, but then he said, you know, I'm really here because I matter, and I want Washington to know that I matter.
Again, that's what a Scott Brown supporter told you. But these candidates are pretty clearly different on issues. He's against tighter regulation of Wall Street. She's for it. He supports waterboarding. She's against it. Do they see, you know, supporters see any conflict with that?
There are only two issues that I could find that where they have surprising positions. Martha Coakley opposes President Obama's surge in Afghanistan. Scott Brown supports the president on that one and goes out on the stump to say that he supports the president. And then there is the issue of abortion. They both support legalized abortion.
Right, although much has been made in the campaign of the fact that he, at one time as a state senator, wrote an amendment that would have allowed hospital emergency rooms to ban emergency contraception for rape victims based on religious beliefs. So a Catholic hospital, for instance, would have been allowed to do that. Her campaign has been making much of that.
And he makes more of it even than she does. He brings it up at every campaign appearance that she is twisting his record, because in the end, when his proposal failed, he did come back and vote for this law that now requires all hospitals in Massachusetts
right.
to provide emergency contraception.
Well, what does each candidate or campaign say they have to do in the remaining hours on a slushy holiday at that to, you know, get across that finish line?
For Brown, it's energize the independents, and for Coakley, it's energize the Democrats.
Well, and remind us, this has always been thought of as a Democratic state, but what are the statistics on who's registered?
Slightly more than half the voters now are independent voters. Of course, those are the voters who tend not to vote in these special elections. And, you know, here we are, we've been seeing them show up at the strip malls for Scott Brown. The question is, are they going to bother to vote on Tuesday, tomorrow? Now, the Brown campaign has not been sort of going after independents in a pie-in-the-sky kind of way. All along, since, you know, last month, they have been targeting 1.1 million independent voters, but only the independent voters who vote in every statewide election. So they are just drumming them with robocalls and trying to get them out to vote for their candidate. But they're counting on people who normally vote.
And that will come as a surprise to people that there are more registered independents in this traditionally Democratic state than Democrats, and 12% Republicans.
And 12% Republicans, yeah.
Here now is Fred Tice talking about the much-anticipated Massachusetts Senate race taking place tomorrow. Fred, thanks so much.
Oh, you're welcome, Robin.
Well, in that race, the Republican candidate has pledged to be the 41st vote, meaning he would give Republicans the 41 votes needed in the Senate to filibuster and block the president's health care reform package. Because of that, White House and Democratic leaders in Congress are scrambling behind the scenes. Gail Chadwick is Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. And Gail, you're there. I should say, I say scrambling. Are you seeing scrambling?
A scrambling may be understating what's going on right now. This is the moment of the Obama presidency, I think.
Really?
They desperately want to get something concrete to say on the State of the Union address that is not talk about hope, that is talk about concrete achievement. And health care is critical. And no one expected 3 months ago that we would be focused like a laser on what was supposed to be a very safe race.
Well, and what are they considering now as far as health care reform? We understand there's a few considerations. One, asking House Democrats to accept the Senate bill. Explain why that's probably tricky.
Well, you don't have a discussion about health care in the last week that doesn't begin with, well, it depends on what happens on Tuesday.
Mm.
Everything turns on that. If a Democrat loses that race, then Democrats have lost their 40 seats in the Senate, and you do not want to have anything have to go back to the Senate again. So the thought is, how can we get the House to pass the Senate bill unamended? Now, that is the bitter pill right now for Democrats. It would mean swallowing abortion language, swallowing the absence of a public option, swallowing financing that their unions are dead set against. The House bill was financed largely with the tax on rich people. The Senate bill is financed largely with the tax on rich health care plans. For the last four negotiation cycles, unions have focused not on wages, but on health care.
Well, let's ask you about that. These are the so-called Cadillac plans.
That's right.
They include plans that, say, business executives have from their companies, but also, originally, at least in the language, some of these tax plans would have included health plans that some blue-collar union members have. But we understand last week the White House reached a compromise with union leaders about taxing those plans. Tell us more.
That you could almost have a movie about that meeting. The account of it I heard was that President Obama, sitting in front of union leaders, said, look, you know, this is a very, he just kind of laid out a technocratic argument for why it's a good idea for cost cutting to cut this cost. And they were just stupefied, just stunned that there would be such a disconnect between the president and such an important element of their base. And they let it be known that if they didn't get this exemption, basically, for deals that were negotiated through collective bargaining, that they would not be there for health care. They didn't say they would vote against it or urge their members to vote against it. They said, we won't be there for you, which is about the same thing.
So the change has been made?
The deal has been made. Now, the question now is, how does that become law? There's no chance to amend the Senate bill if they now feel that the only way to get it through is to take it straight to the House and pass it without amendment.
Well, but we understand there's also sort of a winking understanding that they could pass the Senate bill or reconcile the Senate and the House bill now, and then, you know, people swallow some of their disagreement and then down the road make some changes.
That's right.
Well, but then just what about the politics of that? Would that be seen, as Republicans have said, as, you know, trying to end run this Massachusetts vote and sending the signal that voters don't count?
It would. And it leaves Democrats with a very difficult position because when the president came to speak with the Democratic caucus, House caucus, on last week, his message was this: look, I know you've come back from a very difficult period at home. I know your constituents are angry. I know a lot of you are afraid of the elections coming up in November, which are very likely to turn on health care. However, get me this bill. I will take it to the public and sell it. And the Democrats coming out of that sounded, you know, a little bit tepid about that, but nonetheless, you know, generally supportive. But if it turns out that this president has difficulty selling things, and this is where the Massachusetts race comes up again, he invested a lot of political capital in Sunday's visit. If she loses, and Democrats come to think that, you know, this president isn't a help to us, he may even be a liability, all bets are off for the rest of his agenda.
That's Gail Chadwick, Capitol Hill correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. We just have a few seconds before the break, but just timing. According to Massachusetts law, there'd be, what, 15 days potentially before a new senator is sworn in?
That's right.
And Nancy Pelosi, just checking this again, has also promised 72 hours. Is it 72 before a bill can be voted on?
Correct. She wants it on the Internet so our readers can and the public can look at it.
Well, so there's a timing issue here. We'll continue to follow this with you, Gail, as we, of course, follow tomorrow's election. Gail Chadwick, again, with the Christian Science Monitor at a very scrambling Capitol Hill. Gail, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
Okay, when we come back, we raised this question earlier. Whatever happened to the fairness doctrine? We'll take a look at that history. And later today, have racial attitudes changed? We'll take a look at a new poll. Back in 1 minute, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from The MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
Welcome back. We've been talking about tomorrow's special Senate election here in Massachusetts. The Republican State Senator Scott Brown running neck and neck with the Democrat Attorney General Martha Coakley. Analysts assign the close race to complacency on the part of the Democrats, as well as anger on the part of voters on issues like health care. And last week, we mentioned in passing another potential element, Boston Talk Radio, with the exception of one or two outlets, but including sports talk. It's been all about Scott Brown. We played a short montage from show hosts. Here's a sample.
Vote for Scott Brown. And between now and then, give him a couple bucks if you can. His average.
Every vote for Scott Brown is a vote against the madness. Paul in the car, you are on with Michelle McPhee and Senator Scott Brown. Welcome.
Oh, hey, Scott. Hey, Scott.
And a good morning to you. Tom's
great
all
morning.
Pumped up.
It's great morning.
What are you all so excited about? Is it the new grandchild? Is it the victory of Scott Brown coming next week?
All sorts of good things happening.
Senator Brown.
Yes, Howie. How are you?
Good, good. I voted for you this morning.
I took
an absentee ballot at town hall, and so did Kathy. You've got two votes out of our household.
Thank you.
We help Scott Brown for your state, for your country, for your children, and mine. Go, Scott, go.
Well, after playing that, many of you asked, can they do that? Isn't that unpaid advertising? Isn't there a law? Well, there still is an equal time provision that requires stations who have one candidate on the air to invite the other candidates. But there used to be an FCC regulation that also required contrasting views outside of a candidate's appearance. It was called the Fairness Doctrine. Well, for a little history, we called up Professor T. Barton Carter of Boston University's College of Communication. Professor Barton, the FCC began using this Fairness Doctrine in 1949. What did it set out to do?
The Fairness Doctrine initially had two parts. One was that broadcasters should devote a reasonable percentage of their time to the coverage of public issues. And the second part was that that coverage should be fair in that it allowed a reasonable opportunity for contrasting points of view.
It was meant to sort of level the playing field.
Yes. The concern was that broadcasters had sort of a monopoly.
Well, and Congress backed the policy over several years, and then the Supreme Court upheld it as well. Tell us about the court case in 1969.
That's Red Lion versus the FCC. And the case actually involved one special application of the Fairness Doctrine called the Personal Attack Rule that said if, during a discussion of an issue of public controversy, you attack the character of somebody, they had the right to respond over your airwaves.
And this happened because it was a journalist, Fred Cook, who felt he'd been attacked on a Christian Crusade radio program in Pennsylvania. But you say there's some question as to whether or not he meant to do more with that case?
Yeah, what was the motivation? I mean, was he really concerned about getting a chance to respond over this small Pennsylvania radio station? Or was it part of a broader campaign to try and limit the speech of people supporting conservative candidates?
Well, that was a backstory and a controversy, but what did the Supreme Court rule?
Supreme Court was only asked simply, did this law violate the First Amendment? And they held that it did not because of the scarcity of the airwaves, that therefore the airwaves belong to the people, and that the stations, in fact, owed a so-called fiduciary duty to the listeners, that in fact they had to operate in the interests of the listeners, not their own.
Well, by the 1970s, the FCC called the Fairness Doctrine the single most important requirement of operation in the public interest. Without it, you can't have your license renewed. But then the FCC overturned it in 1987. What happened?
Well, a couple of things happened. One is simply that the FCC's composition changed. And when Reagan came in and appointed new people to the commission, those people, led by Mark Fowler, the chairman, took a different view. And they, in fact, argued that the Fairness Doctrine was really a violation of free speech rights and that it did not enhance the marketplace of ideas or encourage speech, but actually limited it.
Well, this coincided with a move among Republicans to create their own media after claims of liberal bias during the Watergate hearings. David Brock writes about this in his book, The Republican Noise Machine. But what are some other opinions as to what the result has been of the dismantling of the Fairness Doctrine?
Well, I guess it depends at any given point on which side you're on or who you think is getting the most media coverage. Some groups feel that the elimination of the Fairness Doctrine has resulted in a predominance of conservative, especially radio media. And so you had Democrats over the period of time arguing that they should bring back the Fairness Doctrine, that it's necessary, whereas Republicans, more conservatives, argue that this is just the marketplace of ideas and people are hearing what they want. And if people weren't listening, they wouldn't be broadcasting it.
So it was dismantled during the Reagan administration. There have been attempts, though, on the part of Congress to bring it back. What is the debate at that point?
At that point, when they attempt to come back, the debate is, one, whether it's appropriate to have it, but two, whether today it would still be held constitutional under the First Amendment, because the original decision was based on the very limited number of stations and scarcity. And we have a whole different media landscape. You know, it's one thing, for example, when you have three networks dividing up 90% of the television audience. It's another when all of television broadcasting doesn't even have half the video audience today.
So the argument might be that media listening in particular has become balkanized, but that may be the very reason part of an electorate hears one thing and another part hears a completely other thing.
Yes, but the reality is it sounds like most of them are hearing it because that's what they want to hear. They tend to seek the station that gives them whatever they want.
As opposed to giving them two points of view. That's Professor T. Barton Carter of Boston University's School of Communications, an expert in broadcast law. Professor Carter, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Okay, we're going to take a look ahead. Of course, tomorrow is this important Senate race in Massachusetts, but also on Here and Now, we're going to hear from the second-in-command in America's War on Drugs. He wants to add more prevention and treatment to the law enforcement that's already in place. We'll hear from him tomorrow. Still ahead today, a new survey on African-Americans.
Support for Here and Now comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced, Hinckley, Allen & Snyder, where partners have been giving clients practical legal advice for over 100 years throughout New England and now including Connecticut, online at haslaw.com, and the Institute of Contemporary Art on Boston's waterfront, presenting the work of a diverse range of contemporary artists, performers, and more, icaboston.org.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Almost a week after the earthquake, hundreds of thousands of Haitians are struggling to find food and water. Delivery is difficult because of jammed roads, bureaucratic confusion, and fear that convoys could be attacked by desperate people. Meanwhile, news is filtering back to the estimated 500,000 Haitians in the U.S., and some are finding their worst fears have become reality. That's what Here and Now's David Boeri found when he visited the Church of the Nazarene in Boston yesterday.
I have a song in my heart, they sang, in a place of worship no bigger than the room of a funeral parlor. The sweet chorus of 200 local Haitian Americans paired with grief that made the walls shake.
God is good all the time. All the time, God is good.
God is good all the time, exclaimed 25-year-old Ruth Pierre.
I just want to say thank you, God, for watching over the many ones that I'm alive and made it. And I pray that there's plenty more that's alive, even though we don't know how many is gone. Please, please, every day you wake up, give God the glory, because tomorrow's not promised to you.
She stood before the congregation with at least a dozen others to testify to those loved ones who were confirmed to be dead. The first reading was from Revelations 21. For the first heavens and the first earth were passed away. Then came the accounts, apocalyptic, of fathers and mothers, brothers and sisters, children who had all been killed. Of those who were inside when roofs fell and those who had run into shaking houses to get their children out, only to have the roofs collapse. Paula Pierre told of her sister's three-year-old son, trapped in the debris, dead by the time he was pulled out. Tears ran down the cheeks of age-worn Sister Odette as she held a photo of her nephew's wife. They comforted her as the microphone and the box of tissues passed to the next mourner. The pastor who leads them turns and explains in English that the body of Mary Proval's uncle is being thrown away.
Like trash.
Like trash. Thrown away. Like trash.
That's a weird.
Okay.
They're dressed in their Sunday finest. Here in this former health clinic, turned into their own Nazarene church, they praise God that they're in America, while in some cases, racked by guilt that they were not with their families back in Haiti.
I have three kids, but I lost one now. I have two.
His face is frozen, the subtraction terrible. His father-in-law and his daughter died. She was 20 months old. He last saw her the day she was born, before he left for America. Jerry Montelis and the congregation slumped when they heard his story.
He probably had high hope, you know, that child would be joining him soon. Now she's gone, and I could feel the feeling of powerlessness.
The pastor, Pierre-Louis Zephyr, quoted from the Gospel of Matthew, "There shall be famines and pestilence and earthquakes." Hands reaching high and swaying, Nerva Louise prayed for her brother. His wife and son are dead. He's alive, but...
He's
still alive. He's made them to die with no food, no first aid.
No medicine. The pastor himself groans when a man tells the story of his cousin who died. She was 8 months pregnant. Oscar Duberville, who was visiting Haiti and was evacuated yesterday from what he said was an earthquake that never stopped, described what he left behind and what he found here.
Basically, my heart was bleeding. I feel like I'm still bleeding inside, especially when I came here and I saw those people was talking. Just keep on bleeding.
In a room that seemed too small for so much tragedy, their pastor urged them to pray for their sweet country, Haiti.
Here and Now is David Boeri in Boston. And don't forget, if you'd like to help, you can go to our website, hereandnow.org. On this Martin Luther King Day, more Black Americans say they're better off now than at any time in the past 25 years. And according to a new study, they're also more hopeful about the future. The Pew Research Center conducted the survey in association with Juan Williams of National Public Radio. Scott Keeter, the Pew's Director of Survey Research, joins us to dig deep into the findings. And Scott, put them into context for us. You surveyed about 2,800 Black, White, and Hispanic adults nationwide. What did you ask them?
We asked people to tell us if they thought that the condition for African Americans is better or worse now than it was 5 years ago. And this is a question which we've asked a couple of years ago, as well as in this current survey, but it was first asked in 1981 by the Gallup organization. So we have a long-term trend in how African Americans took stock of their own progress. But we wanted to connect it to the opinions of African Americans in late 2007, at a time when we had not entered the big recession, and also at a time when there was the candidacy of Barack Obama, but really not the expectation by anybody that he was going to be the Democratic nominee.
Yeah. Well, and one key statistic, almost 40% of the Black respondents say the situation of Black people in the United States is better now, or a month ago when you took the survey, than it was 5 years ago. That's twice the percentage you found just before Barack Obama was elected president. So what's the link? It's sort of a chicken and egg question. Is there a sunnier outlook on the part of Blacks because he was elected? Or did perhaps his election benefit from an increasingly sunnier outlook?
It's probably a bit of both. And the way we look at it is that we are seeing in several of the questions in the survey, not just the one that you mentioned, but looking forward, will the future for Blacks be better, the degree to which Blacks are satisfied with their communities. On a number of measures, Black outlook on life is better now than it was 2 years ago. And the only thing that really big has happened in the interim is the election, except for the recession, which should have pushed all of these measures in the opposite direction. So we're drawing the inference that it is the election of Obama that has made the difference in the minds of African Americans. Mm-hmm. It's very difficult to say exactly what it was about the election that did it. But I think that at least thinking about the comments that some other observers, including our partner in the survey, Juan Williams, have made, mm-hmm. that African Americans may be looking upon the current situation as the culmination not just of the election, but of a lot of long-term trends in white attitudes about race relations and in other aspects of their lives.
And yet, on the other hand, according to your survey, most Blacks still think there's fundamentally a racial unfairness in America. How does that square?
I think it's important to keep in mind that what we're talking about here is relative change, that there is an improvement in the views of African Americans. And on some questions, there are majorities who say that things are good or getting better. But there still is a lot of concern about discrimination And on a sort of bottom line question, has the country made the changes necessary to give blacks equal rights? Fully 81% of blacks say no, it hasn't. On the other hand, over half of the whites we interviewed say that the country has. So there are big racial divides remaining. It's just that they aren't as big as they were a couple of years ago.
And yet, there's one place where they are converging. Most blacks and white respondents agreed that their two racial groups have become more similar over the past decade. How so?
That's right. Well, we asked two different questions. One of them is about the values held by blacks and whites, and majorities of both blacks and whites see the values of the two races converging, and more blacks today than 2 years ago think that, 60% now. The other question, though, in this pair was about the standard of living, and we found that a majority of both blacks and whites think the standard of living gap between blacks and whites has grown more narrow over the past 10 years. And, of course, what's striking about that is that it's really contrary to the reality that we see in census data about incomes, where there really has not been a convergence of incomes in the decade just past.
Yeah, in fact, African Americans are being hit harder than the general population by, for instance, the recession.
Right.
Well, and another interesting find, you asked about blacks who are still struggling, who maybe can't get ahead. How, you know, what questions did you ask, and what was the response from other blacks?
We have a long-standing trend that goes back to the middle of the 1990s that basically asks people to choose who's responsible for blacks who can't get ahead. Is it blacks themselves, or is it discrimination? And beginning about 2 years ago, we see an emergence of a majority among African Americans saying that it's blacks themselves. It's still a small majority, about 53%, but it's strikingly different than it was back in 1994 when we first asked it, when just over 30% of blacks said that blacks themselves were responsible.
Juan Williams found this particular response fascinating, and he interpreted it as blacks saying to other blacks, it's up to you, you know, pull up your bootstraps and get going.
Yes, I think that's quite plausible, even if we don't have direct evidence of it.
Right. Well, overall, Scott Keeter, what do you and Juan Williams and other researchers say these findings say about racial identity?
I think they are consistent with a long series of survey work over the past several decades. It suggests a growing convergence in the viewpoints between African Americans and whites. Much of the movement that's occurred has happened here in the last 2 years, and it's among African Americans, but there are also changes in the attitudes of whites and Hispanics. We've seen a growth in acceptance of racial intermarriage, for example. And I think the very election of Barack Obama is one symbol of the degree to which racial attitudes in the U.S. have changed.
Yeah. Scott Keeter is the Pew Center's Director of Survey Research, and he's been talking to us about their new findings about how African Americans view themselves. Scott, thanks so much.
It was my pleasure.
And you can check out the Pew Survey and also see what respondents said about the importance of community in their lives at our website, hereandnow.org. And before we take a break, this interesting and somewhat contradictory postscript about a related poll out today. According to a Washington Post ABC News survey, fewer Americans believe Barack Obama's time in office has advanced race relations. This time last year, the pollsters found almost 6 in 10 Americans were hopeful Obama would help improve race relations. Now, 4 in 10 say they don't feel he has. And the drop-off is especially evident among blacks whose optimism declined by a third. However, most respondents, regardless of their race, still think Obama's election represents progress for all African Americans. Well, we'd love to hear your thoughts on this or any story. Remember, you can always go to hereandnow.org and click on Contact Us to send an email. Give us a shout out. And before we go today, she got a shout out at last night's Golden Globes Awards, even if she didn't get the award itself. Director Kathryn Bigelow of the film The Hurt Locker. Back in 1 minute with that. You're listening to Here and Now.
Support for Here and Now comes in part from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live a healthy, productive life. Information at gatesfoundation.org.
Welcome back. When Avatar director James Cameron picked up his Golden Globe for Best Director last night, he paid tribute to another nominee.
Frankly, I thought Catherine was going to get this, so I'm kind of winging it here. And she richly deserves it.
Catherine is his ex-wife, Catherine Bigelow, who directed The Hurt Locker, and a lot of critics would agree with Cameron. In fact, her film just picked up the prestigious Critics' Choice Award for Best Director and Film. Written by Mark Bowl, who was embedded with the U.S. Army Bomb Squad in 2004, and filmed in neighboring Jordan, The Hurt Locker is the story of a fictional EOD, or Explosive Ordnance Disposal Unit, in Iraq. Their job, defusing IEDs, or improvised explosive devices. Jeremy Renner plays Staff Sergeant William James, new to the squad, but not to the work.
How many bombs have you disarmed?
I'm not quite sure, sir.
Sergeant.
Yes.
I asked you a question.
873.
The Hurt Locker is now out on DVD. Here now's Emiko Tamagawa spoke with director Catherine Bigelow when the film was released and asked what drew her to the story.
I'm definitely drawn toward characters or situations that can be very evocative and provocative and create a kind of something that I call sort of experiential cinema. In this case, with The Hurt Locker, it allows you to be put on the ground, a day in the life of a bomb tech. Boots on the ground, you are there, fly on the wall, look at what it might be like to be a bomb tech in Baghdad in 2004.
I want to talk to you about the central characters. There is William James, who is the actual bomb tech, and he's also sort of the new guy on this squad. There's Sanborn, and there's Eldridge. And it's very interesting to see over the course of the film how they develop a relationship, because right at the beginning, you can really see James is a fish out of water with his guys.
Well, he's the new guy. He's thrust into a situation because the former team leader met with a fairly catastrophic demise, and James has a very unusual combination of both a kind of reckless bravado, sort of a swagger and hubris, if you will, but with a profound skill set.
There's a scene where he has underneath his bunk parts of all these bombs that he's diffused, and it's the puzzle that seems to really, really appeal to him.
Uh-huh. This one. This one. From the UN building. Flaming car, dead man's switch, boom. This guy was good, I like him. This one, y'all, is from our first call together. This box is full of stuff that almost killed me.
Every single IED, improvised explosive device, is prototypical. There are no two alike. There's no playbook. Especially in 2004, it was a Wild West. It was the sort of dawn of bombs being the epicenter of this particular conflict. So all of a sudden, EOD, Explosive Ordnance Disposal, is thrust right into center stage, right into the crosshairs of this war. There wasn't a ground-to-ground, air-to-ground. There's not a hill that has to be taken. It's everywhere and completely invisible. You know, in other words, all of these IEDs are disguised actually rather cleverly. So I think of him as kind of an artist, you know, looking each time at a blank canvas, how shall I treat it this time? Is it the red wire? Is it the watch strapped to the side of the bomb? Is this a pressure-activated explosive device? Is it a decoy meant to distract my attention from the real device, which is 5 feet away to my left? I think these men have the most dangerous job in the world, and yet because of the military today, it's a volunteer military. They've chosen this particular profession.
Hey, Eldridge, looks like we're going to need a charge.
Oh, I got that. Figured 4 blocks. That'll give us about 20 pounds of bang total.
That blast is going to roll straight out there. The shell will probably kick out there. Most of the shrapnel is going to shoot straight up in a beautiful umbrella pattern.
Yeah.
We're going to get some smaller pieces and shell fragments this way, but we'll be okay if we're behind the Humvee.
The screenplay was written by Mark Bowl, who wrote In the Valley of Elah. That was one of the films, and there have been a number of films that have addressed the Iraq War. A lot of those films, for a lot of reasons, haven't done well. Some people thought, is it too soon? Or, you know, are they trying to, you know, tell us too much? I mean, when you address a subject like the Iraq War, how do you make sure, you know, in a fiction film that you tell a story that people still want to see?
Well, I think that, although I think it's a really extraordinary movie, Valley of Elah, but I think that, like many of the films that have somewhat similar subject matter, a reintegration into the home front from the effects of this particular conflict. And I think where The Hurt Locker it makes a kind of departure is it's a combat movie. Our desire was to get in theater for specifically bomb techs in Baghdad in 2004 to really make it concrete. Unless you're a member of the military or maybe in the front lines or even have firsthand knowledge of an EOD tech, you don't really understand what a day in their life might be like. And they're not there as aggressors. You know, they're there to render safe these devices. And in doing so, hundreds, if not thousands, of lives are saved. And all of a sudden, you're kind of in brand new territory.
I wanted to ask you just a couple of questions about you as a filmmaker, because one thing in reading about you is realizing that you came to filmmaking from the visual arts, which made me think of one scene that just took me aback when I was watching it. And it was when I believe James was defusing a bomb, and it's very close in, and he's very closely working on it, and then it pulls back. And as it pulls back, you start to see all the parts and the magnitude of it, and it is both beautiful and terrifying. But do you think your background as an artist sort of shapes you as a filmmaker when you...
I think for sure it shapes me. It certainly... I don't think I would even know how to begin to approach a scene like that if I didn't have it. It certainly helps me break it down to have had the visual art background, because it allows me to sort of focus almost exclusively on story and character. I think the visuals come fairly naturally, and so that allows me a lot more emphasis on character, which I think is where all good stories reside.
I wanted to ask you about a particular scene. There's this Iraqi who's been sort of made into an unwitting suicide bomber, and James is trying to defuse, and he's shouting, everybody's shouting. It's this chaos.
Get back!
Shit,
right,
there's too many locks. There's too many. I can't do it. I can't get it off. I'm sorry, okay? You understand? I'm sorry.
Let go of me.
You hear me? I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That was a very emotional sequence to shoot. The Iraqi actor actually was a refugee from the occupation. In fact, he actually was a fairly well-known stage actor in Baghdad. So the opportunity to act again, he was very, very excited. He's so talented, has such a magnificent face. But we shot that sequence, and at the end of the day, when I said wrap, everybody usually on any given natural normal day would grab their equipment and head for the hotel. But everybody was dead still, and they all had, you know, tears in their eyes. It was a very, very, very moving shoot, that sequence.
Some soldiers have seen this film. Can you talk just a little bit about how they've reacted?
I've had extraordinary reactions. In fact, we showed it to the EOD Explosive Ordnance Disposal community, and basically, I mean, the members that I've spoken to, they sort of felt like every other sector of the military has had their film. Like, you've had a Navy SEAL film, you've had Top Gun, you've had this and that. But EOD has never had their moment on the screen. And if there was ever a moment as a result, sadly, of this conflict, this is their moment.